Thank you for attending session 215 entitled Polygamy Beyond Mormonism. Congratulations for surviving your first full day at the Sunstone. We're excited to open up our Friday sessions. Today we invite you to reflect on the diversity that exists in this space today. All those in attendance today are brought together through various paths in the restoration movement. As you move through your day, feel free to reach out to a stranger, make friends with someone new, and let yourself be challenged. Before we begin, we insist that you turn off your cell phone. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind as we engage in the Q&A portion of this session following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by these guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so that presentations can begin preparation or present. Presenters can begin preparation for the next session. About this session. Polygamy is common in most large animals, from deer to elk to the great apes and more. Is polygamy natural amongst humans? Would modern young people benefit from practicing a non-patriarchal polygamy? How do modern Americans feel about polygamy? Tom has traveled the country asking these questions, and the answers may surprise you. Tom Bennett is a roaming mystic and full-time traveling musician. He gave two lectures at Sunstone in 2018 and performed his original music in 2017. I was there. It was great. He's been a Baptist, a Mormon fundamentalist, a Buddhist, and an occultist. His spirituality is defined by the statement, "I am constantly in awe of the great mystery which surrounds us." And now, put your hands together for Tom!
Man, I thought you guys were going to give me a warm welcome. Thanks for being here. If I wasn't given this talk, there were a lot of talks at this time that I really wanted to check out. So, for the benefit of the audience that will be listening to the recording, thank you for attending. Thank you for listening. My name is Tom Bennett, and this talk is Polygamy Beyond Mormonism. In this talk, I will address various forms of polygamy as it exists outside of Mormonism. Many familiar with polygamy know that it can be found in Islam, but what do we know about the practice beyond that? How common is polygamy? What does it look like from culture to culture? Is it the domain of a religious fundamentalist, or does the practice have a broader reach? As a word, polygamy has its origins in the late Greek polygamia. It is the practice of marrying multiple spouses. There are various forms of polygamy. When a man is married to more than one wife at a time, sociologists call this polygyny. When a woman is married to more than one husband at a time, it is called polyandry. If a marriage includes multiple husbands and wives, it can be called a group marriage or communal marriage, or as one group, the Oneida community, called it, complex marriage. Various societies, communities, and civilizations have experimented with forms of polygamy all around the world. It is practiced by people of diverse races, financial status, and cultures, and while not the norm, it is prevalent. The polygamy that I imagine most of us to be familiar with in this room is the plural marriage found in Mormonism. Plural marriage has been one of the highest tenets of the faith. It has also been the subject of denial and derision. The Judeo-Christian practice has its roots in the Abrahamic covenant. Abraham, who is recognized as a prophet by Jews, Christians, and Muslims alike, made a covenant with God. As a reward for his faithfulness to God, Abraham was promised that he would be the father of nations, that his seed would be as numerous as the stars in the heavens or the grains of sand upon the sea. To early Mormons, plural marriage was the doctrine by which men and women were exalted with their families to become like unto God. LDS prophet Joseph Smith revealed the practice after having lived it secretly. He claimed that he was instructed to live the principle or he would be destroyed. After the death of Joseph Smith, the principle came west with Brigham Young and the Saints to Deseret, which later became the state of Utah. In Utah, plural marriage was practiced openly until 1886, at which time it went underground, the church having issued a manifesto separating themselves from the practice at the insistence of the United States government and, as the church claims, by revelation from God himself. Despite the 132 years since the church formally denounced the principle, polygamy still remains a hot topic. After learning of the plural marriage of Mormonism, I became interested in looking at how other cultures have practiced polygamy and whether it is found elsewhere in nature. I was surprised to see polygamy was prevalent in many forms everywhere I looked. The practice of polygamy is as old as mankind. It has its origins in nature itself, wherein it can be found amongst mammals, fishes, and fowl. As one searches the cultures of the world, the most common form, polygyny, the practice of one male with many females, is abundant. We find polygyny amongst the Muslims, the Chinese, the Native Americans, and beyond. In Africa, the Americas, and Southeast Asia in the pre-modern era, circa 600 BCE to 1600 CE, both monogamy and polygyny occurred. Though more rare, polygyny occurred even in areas where monogamy was prevalent. Wealth played a key role in the development of family life during these times. Abundant wealth enabled the more powerful men to have a principal wife and several secondary wives. This is commonly known as resource polygyny. Local rulers of villages usually had the most wives as a sign of power and status. Conquerors of villages would often marry the daughters of former leaders as a symbol of conquest and also to create unity. The practice of resource polygyny continued with the spread and expansion of Islam into Africa and Southeast Asia. Children born into these households were considered free when they might otherwise be born into slavery. Children born to free or slave concubines were free, but had lesser status than those born to the wives. Living arrangements varied between areas. In Africa, each wife usually had their own house as well as property and animals. The idea that all property was owned by the husband originated in Europe and was not recognized in Africa. In many other parts of the world, wives lived together in seclusion under one household. When we look amongst the Native Americans, we find polygyny was practiced in many tribes, even as the Native people began to integrate with white European culture. Amongst the Native people, it was generally understood that a man could have as many wives as he could care for. Marriage to many Native American peoples could be as simple as living together as mates. Often, there was no ceremony involved, and marriage was recognized when a woman came to live with a man or the man with a woman, depending on the customs of the particular tribe. Most Native peoples considered the woman as the property owner, and a family's possessions would stay with her. The woman was considered homemaker, and though the whole family and tribe would work together to ensure survival in the form of farming and gathering, it was the woman who was often matriarch and leader of matters of family life. The native man was primarily hunter and warrior, and the more wives he had, the more he could ensure a well-cared-for family with more numerous and healthy offspring. There were also examples of Native men taking the wives of a fallen brother or close tribe member, as we see in other cultures, especially amongst Old Testament Jews. Some well-known polygamous Native Americans include Geronimo, Sitting Bull, Quanah Parker. Geronimo, the most famous warrior medicine man amongst the Apache of Arizona and New Mexico, became a warrior after Mexican soldiers killed his first wife, his mother, and his children, while he was away trading. He went on to marry 8 more wives, qualifying him for the celestial kingdom. Of his first wife, Alope, Geronimo said, "She was slender, fair, dutiful, and loyal. The two had been lovers for a very long time, and Geronimo considered marrying her to be the greatest joy life offered to him. Upon her murder, he said, the Mexicans had cut off her hair." Now, to the Native Americans, removal of the hair caused a great deal of difficulty in the spirit world, often stopping the spirit from further progression, which is very interesting to note. It's a similarity you'll see in many cultures. Speaking of the hair being removed, he said, "I did not pray, nor did I resolve to do anything. I had no purpose left." Geronimo's third wife was also murdered in 1861. Another of Geronimo's wives was taken by the Mexicans as a slave. 2 of his wives were captured and placed on a reservation. And upon his surrender, he was reunited with these 2 and lived with them the remainder of his life. So he had it really rough, and so did his family. Sitting Bull, another prominent Native chief, had plural wives. He was Lakota, commonly called Sioux, and was born along the Yellowstone River. He had 5 wives. Their names were Light Hair, 4 Robes, Snow on Her, Seen by Her Nation, and Scarlet Woman. Some reports that I found claim that he had at least 9 wives. Quanah Parker, a Comanche, was well known as the founder of the Native American Church, an amalgamation of Native and Christian theology that used the psychedelic peyote as a sacrament. Parker was half white and achieved great success in the white world. He was the husband of 7 wives. He gained great wealth as a rancher. He took his first 2 wives in 1872. He was the father of 25 children, some of which were adopted. While he embraced many aspects of white culture, he stood in firm opposition to American marriage laws. Plural marriage has also existed amongst Asian cultures. The original wife or legal wife was referred to as the Xingxi, translated as main room, both in China, Japan, and Korea. Dapo, which stands for big wife or big woman, is the slang term. Both terms indicate hierarchy. The official wife was called Big Mother, Dama, or Dame, mother or aunt. The child of the concubine addressed the Big Mother as aunt. The written word for the second woman was Sishi, and literally means she who occupies the side room. This word was also used in both Korea and Japan. They were called, and I don't know if I pronounced this one correctly, it's just Q-I-E, Ki, I don't know, in China and Korea. The common terms, The common terms referring to the second wife and the act of having the second woman respectively are erne, literally the second wife. Now, I'm probably pronouncing these incorrectly, but I do have them written down, so if you want to reference them, I'd be happy to show you, and you can research further if it interests you. Concubinage was supported by the law until the end of the Qing dynasty of the Imperial China government in 1911. In the past, emperors could and often did have hundreds to thousands of concubines. Rich officials and merchants of the elite also took concubines in addition to legal wives. The first wife was the head or mother wife. Other wives were under her headship if the husband was away. Concubines had a lower status than full wives, generally not being seen in public with their husband and not having rights to decisions in the household. Children from concubines were considered inferior to those of the wife and did not receive equal wealth / legacy from their father. However, they were considered legitimate and therefore had many more rights to inheritance of status and wealth than illegitimate children conceived outside of a marriage or family structure. Polygamy existed in China as well. One of the world's most prolific patriarchs was a ruler of the Ming Dynasty in China named Jiokanaga. His modern-day genetic offspring, and this is very interesting, are estimated at 1.5 million men in modern northern China. Wow. Gio Kanaga died in 1583. Gio Kanga, that's, I guess, better pronunciation, Gio Kanga. His legacy lived on as his grandson would establish the Qing dynasty that ruled China between 1644 and 1912. Polygyny was widely practiced in the Republic of China from 1911 to 1949 before Kuomintang was defeated in the Civil War and forced to escape to Ryukyu, now known as Okinawa, Formosa, and Pescadores. Zhang Zongcheng, a well-known warlord, notably declared he had three unknowns: an unknown number of rifles, an unknown amount of money, and an unknown number of women. After the People's Republic of China was founded in 1949, polygamy was outlawed. Many women, when joking about polygyny, will say that they wish that they could have multiple husbands. Ladies, I know the place for you. The views are exceptional, but it is known to be a little cold. The women of rural Tibet sometimes have multiple husbands. Polyandry is a rare marital arrangement in which a woman has several husbands. In Tibet, these husbands are often brothers. This practice is called fraternal polyandry. Concern over which children are fathered by which brother falls on the wife alone. She may or may not say who the father is because she does not wish to create conflict in the family or is unsure who the biological father is. Historically, the social system compelled marriage within a social class. Since 1981, the Tibet Autonomous Region government no longer permits new polyandric marriages. Even though it is currently illegal, polyandry in Tibet is still the norm in most rural areas. Where polygyny has been associated with wealth, Tibetan polyandry seems at least to be associated more with environment. One reason put forward by anthropologists suggests that the Tibetan terrain is very difficult. Often, the soil is steep, frozen, and rocky. This makes it difficult to farm. This requires more physical strength. Therefore, women take on more husbands. There are also theories that Tibetans practice polyandry to ensure that their estates aren't divided. If each brother owes half to his own wife, if each brother owes part of what he has to his own wife, but instead they share a wife, there are less inheritances to be split. Another factor that led to less division of land through inheritance is that Tibet is a Buddhist nation, with as much as 20% of the population being celibate monks. It is interesting to note that families with more sisters would also practice polygyny for the same purpose, with a single man marrying a group of sisters. So with Tibet, it tends to go whatever way situations dictate. Another religion associated with polygyny, besides Mormonism, is of course Islam. The Muslim practice of polygyny finds its example in Muhammad, the founder of the faith and the example of emulation. Muslim men are allowed to practice polygyny, that is, they can have more than one wife at the same time, up to a total of four. A man does not need the approval of his first wife for second marriage, as there is no evidence in the Quran or Hadith to suggest this. The only requirement is to create fairness amongst his wives and to never hurt one wife to please another, as this would be unjust. If this requirement cannot be fulfilled, then he must only marry one woman. Through the centuries, much has been written that is critical of Muhammad's multiple marriages. It is estimated that he had as many as nine wives simultaneously. The reported total number of wives is up to 12. The usual Islamic response to the criticism is that Muhammad did not form these marriages out of lust or a desire for sexual relations. Rather, the marriages were due to the following factors. One, the desire to form alliances with diverse clans due to the swift expansion of Islam, thereby bringing peace with enemies by marrying their daughters. Two, the need to emancipate conquered clans by linking them to Muslim family clans. Three, Muhammad's desire to render benevolent assistance and care to widows, especially widows of men killed in battle, or to displace a slave or captive. Many countries with high Muslim populations allow Muslim men to practice polygyny within the bounds of the law. The case of Muhammad and Islam allows us to take a look at another issue commonly raised when speaking of polygyny, the question of age of consent. Aisha, again, pronunciation may not be correct there. I'm working the best I can with a lot of different nations here. One of his wives was only 6 years old when Muhammad claimed to have received a dream instructing him to marry her. He was past 50 at the time. What possible rationale can be offered to legitimize this intention? Much is made of the fact that Muhammad did not consummate the marriage at this point, yet it is still admitted that he did so within 3 years of marrying Aisha at the ripe old age of 9. It is difficult to justify this behavior, commandment of God or not. It has been my experience that most Americans see absolutely no problem with consenting adults practicing polygyny or polygamy or any form of non-traditional marriage, and I've asked hundreds of people their opinion on it. However, I have not encountered one person that does not see a major problem with child rape. However, it must be said that this practice is not common in Islam or in any other form of polygyny, and my mentioning it is not meant to offend Muslims or speak ill of their faith. Many associate African polygyny with Islam. However, polygyny existed in Africa independent of Islam. Amongst the Logoli people of Kenya, we see more resource-based polygyny. Large families enhanced the prestige of Logoli men. Logoli men with large families were also capable of obtaining justice, as they would be feared by family, be feared by people who would not dare to use force to take their livestock or other goods from them due to the size of their large families. Interviews with some contemporary Logoli men and women who recently made polygynous marriages yielded data that suggests that marrying another wife is usually approached with considerable thought and deliberation by the man. It may or may not involve or require the consent of the other wives and prospective wife's parents. A type of surrogate pregnancy arrangement was reported to have been observed, in which some wives who are unable to bear children find fulfillment in the children and family provided by a husband taking additional wives. Some of the men indicated that they were pressured by their parents to marry another wife who could contribute additional income to the family. Some of the young polygynous men indicated that they were trapped in polygyny because of the large number of single women who needed and were willing to take them as husbands, although they were already married. Most of these second and third wives were older women who had not yet been married. The royal and noble families of Nigeria have also traditionally practiced polygyny. Now, earlier at the beginning of this talk, I mentioned the Oneida community. They are a very interesting case of polygamy. John Humphrey Noyes led the Oneida community, which was contemporary with the Utopian movement, which flourished in the United States as well as Europe. A utopia is an imagined community or society that possesses highly desirable or nearly perfect qualities for its citizens. The term utopia was coined from Greek by Sir Thomas More in his 1516 book, Utopia, describing a fictional island society in the South Atlantic Ocean off the coast of South America. The word comes from the Greek words which translate as not and place, meaning no place. Utopian communities as an ideal have existed since the time of Plato's Republic. The Oneida community was a perfectionist religious communal society founded by John Humphrey Noyes in 1848 in Oneida, New York. The community believed that Jesus had already returned in AD 70, which is interesting because there's a man proposing that same argument here, making it possible for them to bring about Jesus' millennial kingdom themselves and to be free of sin and perfect in this world, not just in heaven, a belief called perfectionism. The Oneida community practiced communalism in the sense of communal property and possessions. They practiced complex marriage, male sexual continence, and mutual criticism. There were smaller Noyesian communities in Wallingford, Connecticut, Newark, New Jersey, Putney, and Cambridge, Vermont. The community's original 87 members grew to 172 by February of 1850, 208 by 1852, and 306 by 1878. The branches were closed in 1854, except for the Wallingford branch, which operated until devastated by a tornado in 1878. The Oneida community dissolved in 1881, and interestingly enough, eventually became the giant silverware company known as Oneida Limited. They had unique family structures that were polygamist in nature. The phrase free love, which became a household term, originates with this man Noyce and Oneida. The Oneida community believed strongly in a system of free love, known as complex marriage, wherein any member was free to have sexual relations with any other member who consented. Possessiveness and exclusive relationships were frowned upon. Unlike 20th century social movements such as the sexual revolution of the 1960s, the Oneidans did not seek consequence-free sex for pleasure, but believed that, because the natural outcome of intercourse was pregnancy, raising children should be a communal responsibility. Women over the age of 40 were to act as sexual mentors to adolescent boys, as these relationships had minimal chances of conceiving. Furthermore, these women became religious role models for the young men. Likewise, older men often introduced young women to sex. Noyce often used his own judgment in determining the partnerships that would form and would often encourage relationships between the non-devout and the devout in the community, in the hopes that the attitudes and behaviors of the devout would influence the non-devout. To control reproduction within the Oneida community, a system of male continence, or coitus reservatus, was enacted. John Humphrey Noyce decided that sexual intercourse served two distinct purposes. In male continence, Noyce argued that the method simply produces the subordination of the flesh to the spirit, teaching men to seek principally the elevated spiritual pleasures of sexual connection. The primary purpose of male continence was social satisfaction, quote, to allow the sexes to communicate and express affection for one another, end quote. The second purpose was procreation. Of around 200 adults using male continence as birth control in their community, there were 12 unplanned births within Oneida between 1848 and 1868. It's pretty effective, indicating that it was a very effective form of birth control. Young men were introduced to male continence by women who were postmenopausal, and young women were introduced by experienced older males. Noyce believed that ejaculation, quote, drained men's vitality and led to disease. Now, this was a common belief in the time, and among some communities persists to this day. He also believed that pregnancy and childbirth levied a heavy tax on the vitality of women. Noyce founded male continence to spare his wife Harriet from more difficult childbirths after five traumatizing births, of which four led to the death of the child. The community favored this method of male continence over other methods of birth control because they found it to be natural, healthy, and favorable for the development of intimate relationships. Women found increased sexual satisfaction in the practice, and Oneida is regarded as highly unusual in the value they placed on women's sexual satisfaction. If a male failed in this, in the privacy of reservation, they faced public disapproval, as Oneida also had the practice of publicly discussing its members' faults in open meetings. This would also result in sexual rejection. So basically, in short, if you weren't able to practice the reservation, they might talk about it in front of the whole community. It is unclear whether the practice of male continence led to significant problems. The term free love came to prominence amongst the hippies and the American counterculture of the 1960s. Despite the culture of conservatism, which had defined previous generations, free love became a household word. The young people of the era found their parents' generation to be lacking in freedom and new ideas. As people experimented with their philosophies and social structures, America saw an increase in polyamory. By definition, free love is a social movement that accepts all form of love. The Free Love Movement's initial goal was to separate the state from sexual matters such as marriage, birth control, and adultery. He claimed that such issues were the concern of the people involved and no one else. While the phrase free love is often associated with promiscuity in the popular imagination, especially in reference to the counterculture of the 60s and 70s, historically the free love movement has not advocated multiple sexual partners or short-term sexual relationships. Rather, it is argued that sexual relations that are freely entered into should not be regulated by law. To proponents of free love, the act of sex was not just about reproduction. Access to birth control was considered a means to women's independence, and leading birth control activists also embraced free love. Sexual radicals remain focused on their attempts to uphold a woman's right to control her body and to freely discuss issues such as contraception, marital sexual abuse, emotional and physical, and sexual education. These people believe that by talking about female sexuality, they would help empower women. To help achieve this goal, such radical thinkers relied on the written word, books, pamphlets, and periodicals. And by these means, the movement was sustained for over 50 years, spreading the message of free love all over the United States. There is a noted absence of polygamy in the early days of Christianity. While the Jews were still practicing it, the early Christians were more inclined to follow Roman law, which forbade the practice. When speaking of polygamy, and if anyone can correct this name, Tertullian, it's an early philosopher, the father of Latin Christianity, explicitly tackled the polygamy of the patriarchs. He wrote, quote, "Each pronouncement and arrangement is the act of one and the same God, who did then indeed, in the beginning, send forth the sowing of the race by an indulgent laxity granted to the reins of connubial alliances until the world shall be replenished, until the material of the new disciples should attain to forwardness. Now, however, at the extreme boundaries of the times, has checked this command which he had sent out and recalled the indulgence which he had granted." Quite wordy. On polygamy, Martin Luther wrote, "I confess that I cannot forbid a person to marry several wives, for it does not contradict Scripture. If a man wishes to marry more than one wife, he should be asked whether he is satisfied in his conscience that he may do so in accordance with the Word of God. In such a case, the civil authority has nothing to do in the matter." Seems relatively wise to me. The Anabaptists of Munster, Germany, initially opposed the idea of plural marriage. However, they later defended plural marriage. The founder of the Bernard Rothsman, took 9 wives himself, saying, quote, "God has restored the true practice of holy matrimony amongst us. Except for a few cases, polygamy was not practiced amongst early or Middle Ages Christianity, it seems." Perhaps the most prolific polygamist of all time would be the great Mongolian warlord Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan had 6 Mongolian wives and over 500 concubines. Geneticists estimate that 16 million living men are the genetic descendants of Genghis Khan, making him one of, if not the most prolific patriarchs in the history of the world. Even more astounding was that up to 8% of men living within the former area of Mongolia Empire have Y chromosomes related to that royal line. The line of descent goes back around 1,000 years. Genghis Khan was born around 1162 in Mongolia. He first married at age 16, but took many other wives and mistresses during his lifetime. Khan's first wife, Borte, B-O-R-T-E, gave birth to 4 sons who would become heirs to the dynasty. After conquering a territory, Genghis Khan would get the first pick of women to add to his harem. Some estimates suggest that he impregnated over 1,000 different women. It is unknown how many children he fathered. Khan died in 1227, possibly from fatigue or respiratory disease. Fair enough. On top of war and everything else. The heirs to Genghis Khan were also prolific. One of his children was thought to have had 40 sons of his own by wives and concubines, with an unknown number of children from many other women. These children of Khan having had many more children, helped to expand his genetic legacy across the continent and across much of the known world. By this point, we have estimated that plural family structures have existed through history and many cultures. Many different reasons and circumstances have caused polygyny to flourish. I'd like to propose perhaps the most rational reason of all, which is simply this: polygyny is natural. The following is from an article that I wrote entitled "Polygyny Amongst the Species, a Natural Law." It is my intention here to demonstrate that polygyny is the natural law. Amongst animals, it is widely practiced with great success and is the preferred family structure. Often the defense of polygyny is presented from a religious perspective, from the majority of literature on the topic coming from Mormon fundamentalists, Muslim, or Christian sources. These communities approach polygyny as a spiritual principle, a religious law. My approach will be somewhat different, as I will approach it from a naturalist perspective. I would like to state that I consider natural law to be an emanation of spiritual law, perhaps the highest law of the will of the divine, as nature is not defined by the whims and fluctuating philosophies and social mores of man. If one believes in a creator God, it is a commonly held belief that God created nature. Even before creating man, God was busy with the work of creating nature and setting into order the laws upon which it is governed. If one does not believe in a creator God, this principle still remains, that nature is and that it acts according to the law of survival, regardless of if these laws have an author independent of nature itself. It would be reasonable to state that the first law of nature is self-preservation. To survive, thrive, and mate is something which every species on this planet aims to do above all else. In the scriptures, the law was given to go forth and multiply. Nature is singly focused on this aim: the preservation of self, the preservation of mass, the spreading of the genome. In the context of righteousness and sin, nature stands in a state of innocence. The Christians teach that beast and the plant are not capable of these ethical states. Nature simply is. I would argue that if created, nature stands as created and is self-existing, and if self-existing, it is simply what it is. In either perspective, nature acts according to its own dictates. This would qualify nature as acting under the will of God in the eyes of the religionist. Though religion states that animal is less than man, nevertheless, nature is pure in the eyes of God. Assuming that nature is pure and holy in the eyes of God, and that the law of self-preservation is the law of nature and thus the law of God, let us look at one of the most common ways in which this law is enacted. Let us look at the mating system of polygyny. A great many animals from a wide range of species ensure their genetic survival by polygyny. In fact, polygynous mating structures are estimated to occur in up to 90% of mammal species. Animals that employ this family structure include the elephant seal, gorilla, red-ringed warbler bird, house wren, hamadryas baboon, common pheasant, various deer, elk, and Bengal tigers, amongst many, many, many more. Many types of male fish have multiple female mates. They also spawn, allowing them to fertilize the eggs of many females, thus acting in a form of polygyny. What are the benefits that cause so many species to practice polygyny? This system allows the fittest of males to ensure that their progeny will continue. Only this male will mate. His fitness is proven by the near constant challenge of other male rivals. He must fight to defend his territory, his females, and his food sources. This requires not only physical prowess, but also mental. The right to be the alpha or dominant male is earned both by pedigree and power. This ensures that the strongest of the breed becomes the standard for the family unit. His young take on his traits of health and vitality. When he becomes unable to retain his status, the next in line will arise and the cycle continues. Amongst the females, there are great benefits as well. Her young will be the offspring of the alpha male and be better equipped for survival and thriving, making her task as a mother a slight bit easier. Her offspring are less likely to fall ill or to be lame. Also, there are numerous other females present to assist in the raising of the offspring. These offspring may enjoy better socialization in ideal settings. In essence, many hands make light work, and many mothers make happier, healthy offspring. There are downsides, however. Animals employing this mating system must be sure not to weaken their genetics by excessive inbreeding. Amongst some species, the majority of parenting responsibility seems to be left to the female, but this is not always the case. Many males of various species assist in food collection, nest or home building, protecting the family and territory, providing the best resources, allowing the female to spend more time with the young. Amongst some species, such as the great red warbler, song repertoire is an important part of establishing himself as alpha male. This provides examples that it isn't always might that makes right, so to speak, but that the male's ability to provide quality of life in the form of song and a tidy home matter a great deal to many females. I was very surprised to find this referred to as the sexy son hypothesis. That's interesting. Among scientists, a.k.a. good-looking dudes get the chicks. Males with more symmetrical features are considered in many species to have better genes. These males are more likely to become alphas. From an evolutionary standpoint, the most predominant characteristic that is often found in polygynous mating system is extreme sexual dimorphism, namely more masculine males and more feminine women. It was interesting to find that that is a natural trait of polygyny in almost all animal species. Let's see here. Here we go. To translate, this means larger fangs and bigger bodies amongst males and females that can reach sexual maturity earlier. While polygyny is not the absolute rule, it is certainly the exception throughout the entirety of animal life. Depending on what you view man to be, one may ask the question, why is polygyny not the rule with humans? Some would state that a form of it, in fact, is, with many human beings being prone to promiscuity, which, morality of man aside, is also found in some animals, in which it could be argued is in part people trying to practice polygyny, but lacking societal acceptance. But that is another conversation for another time. So I'd like to thank you all for joining us today for this talk, Polygamy Beyond Mormonism. I hope I've been able to put polygamy into a new context for you. And if anyone has any questions, I will gladly do my best to answer them for you. Thank you for attending.
And thank you for using the microphone to ask him your questions so that we can record it.
Okay, so I've got you brought a couple of issues that I think are interesting. Sexual dimorphism, you say, primarily falls in species with polygyny. Mm-hmm. And humans are fairly sexually dimorphic. Mm-hmm. I also wondered if you had read the book Sex at Dawn, which was supposed to be a research about early genetic evidence as well, but early sociological evidence that early hunter-gatherer clans of humans before settled agrarian societies were pretty much promiscuous is kind of the word that they would more use than any particular other form, but that that there's a whole lot of that sexual difference. So I wondered if you'd read those books, or if you could speak a little bit to human sexual dimorphism. And then my second question is about the tendency for humans in settled societies. We want not to have that male conflict, mm-hmm. right? So do you have any theories on the rise of monogamy, maybe as a social construct?
Great questions. I have not read that book, but that sounds very fascinating, and it sounds like a book like that would add a lot of very relevant information to this. And it would seem that that would only be natural, that that's the way that early humans would have conducted themselves, being that if you approach it from that anthropological viewpoint, I mean, we are great apes. We are another type of animal. And so it would make sense that, that people did conduct themselves. And, you know, just like we addressed in this talk, it seems that, you know, again, while not being the most dominant familial structure, polygyny has been practiced all around the world and only has seen a decline in very recent times, which leads to your second point that you brought up, a change in the way we live as human beings. You know, more settled societies, the way we gain our resources has changed. You know, the common human of our time gains their resources through the work of their mind. Even if they're doing manual labor, it's still a skilled form, you know, compared to hunter-gatherer, fighting for resources, you know, more so-called base survival. So I think it just seems like monogamy has risen, yeah, as a natural evolution. Also, though, Rome. You know, Rome is, our whole world is dictated by concepts that originally came from Rome. And Rome, I don't know an awful lot about, you know, the familial structures of ancient Rome, but it was monogamous, even though they had a lot of side relationships, it seemed, which we would view as very abnormal or uncommon today, I guess you would say, and perhaps morally wrong in a lot of respects to most people. But they're the authors of monogamy, too, so... I hope that addresses it a little bit, because I need to learn more about these things as well. Any other questions, comments?
About 3 years ago, Sunstone published an article by me, kind of a libertarian advocacy of polygamy. And, you know, the other side of the alpha male is the Lost Boys.
Yes.
If you've been around St. George, you know.
I live down there.
Which is pathological. So, and we also see contemporaneously the males are falling behind women in terms of going to college, graduating from college, not being addicted, et cetera, et cetera. So in my mind, the optimal level of polygamy would be just to pick up the slack of the deficient males so that males who want to be married can, who are capable of it, but which is apparently a declining share, but the women who do desire to be married and have kids, why not?
I agree with you completely, and it all goes back to, like you said, a libertarian concept. Adults, at least in America, it's my opinion, should be free to do as they will, as long as they're not imposing upon the will of someone else. And that's what I found in my conversations with people, because I'll be speaking later. I put on a music festival in Short Creek, and I've made a lot of friends with the people there, and I travel promoting that festival. And people say, oh, the polygamous people. And I say, yes, yeah, that's who they have, who they traditionally have been. And almost everyone, without exception, says, you know, I have no problem with that at all. All I have a problem with is abuse. And I say, well, yeah, that's the common consent, because it resonates with people as a natural condition. I mean, it's what people do anyway. I mean, in the times we live in, people generally have more than one sexual partner unless they are married, and maybe they do then too. People should be free, and it would change things. I know, me personally, I have a lot of friends that are women, and a lot of them are very capable, intelligent, beautiful, you know, just powerful women in every way. And I hear all the time, heard it last night from, I was sitting at a table with six women, you know, and they were just like, well, I wish there were some men around here that would, you know, put forth the effort to talk to us or build a relationship, you know, and well, maybe there are men that would.
You're sort of also reminding me of one more thing I'd like to ask a question about, and that is, and maybe this is more in the context of Mormonism, but serial monogamy. We don't really have true monogamy as humans in any society that I'm aware of, where you're strictly limited to one sexual partner. If one of them dies, for example, that the other is therefore celibate, for example. So we don't really have true monogamy. We have the serial monogamy where you're only with one person at a time.
Right.
But, you know, if in modern dating culture, you also end up with a lot of this, well, people will have dozens of sexual partners over a lifetime,
mm-hmm.
Even if they're with somebody for a year or a month here or 3 years there,
mm-hmm.
that they will move on. And I kind of wonder, would you consider that a form of polygyny or polygamy?
A form of polygamy, yes.
For both sexes. So.
Yes, I would. Yeah, I would definitely consider that a form of polygamy. And that observation just goes to further show that it is natural for humans to conduct themselves that way.
And I guess the reason I brought that up in the Mormon context is that when Mormonism, we talk about how these relationships are eternal.
Mm-hmm.
Then you run into the situation where any serial monogamist in, say, even the mainstream LDS church could therefore become a polygamist in that spiritual sense.
Mm-hmm.
If all of these relationships are permanent, then the mere end of one relationship by regular standards is not actually the end of that relationship.
Yes.
Theologically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting how, you know, it often comes up in Mormonism. People say, oh, Mormons still believe in polygamy because there are still numerous circumstances that would place one in a state of polygyny in the hereafter. So, yeah, good observation.
Yeah, I just kind of want to make a comment. It's amazing how many people nowadays seem to get married through the state, and then all of a sudden they have to have a mistress on the side or whatever you want to call the male part, counterpart. And then it destroys the marriage. It seems like polygamy or this polygyny type thing seems to be in our genes of most people still, even though we tend to say, no, we're not. They have to have more than one partner at all times. And I don't know, have you ever thought about that? Why maybe people do that? Is it, you think it's more like the animalistic side of us or anything?
Yeah, I think it's just natural. And I think people would conduct themselves quite a bit differently without societal constructs the way they are. You know, for example, I think you would see a lot of non-religious polygamists if people just thought that they could do it. You know, do you know what I mean by that? Like, it's just the rules kind of set the parameters. And I think we're coming into a time where people are like, why? Why? Why do I have to do it that way? And so you're starting to see all kinds of. I've seen examples of relationships where there was like an alpha female with numerous female partners too. You know, there's all kinds of structures of human relations, and I'm of the opinion nobody should be able to tell anybody anything about it.
Do you think there'll be a time soon where we will actually be able to live polygamy legally?
That's a good question. Well, you know, as far as Utah, it keeps being legal and then illegal and back and forth. And when you see something being made legal and then illegal and back and forth the way it has been, at least in the state of Utah, I don't think it has anything to do with polygamy, and it has everything to do with control. You know, and just saying, we have the right to keep you under our thumb. People are going to do what they want to do anyway. And I think with the increase of liberty that we're starting to see in some arenas of American life, while it's being greatly reduced in others, right? We have the illusions of freedom that are being, you know, promulgated or pushed, but it's not a true freedom. I think people are starting to get to the idea of just shrugging off a lot of different laws they find unjust. And there's a famous quote, something about that, when laws are unjust, it's the duty of any just man to oppose them or something, you know, something of that nature. And I think as more and more people start exerting their freedoms, it would only be inevitable that laws would be changed. And they definitely should be, in my opinion, because the negative associations that people like to bring up associated with polygamy tend to recoil when brought into the broad daylight. You know, it's only because people are hiding things and they feel like they have to lie, and it shouldn't have to be that way.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to the same question of somebody gets married to somebody and they have a mistress. We don't find that as an illegal type thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can have all the mistresses you want and never get to go to court.
I think it is technically illegal, but I don't think
it's
prosecuted.
It's possibility. Well, yeah, it probably would be because adultery, type thing, but you just don't see that. But if you see somebody says, I'm married to two people, a bigamist or even more, mm-hmm. it's automatically seen running right through the court system.
Right.
So it seems only logical that it would happen. I just didn't know if you knew that.
It does seem logical that it would happen. I guess we'll just have to keep – people have to stand for their rights. And, you know, I know I put on my music festival in Colorado City, and I have numerous friends that grew up in both the FLDS and Centennial Park community. And amongst some communities I've experienced – so, for example, I'm friends on Facebook with a lot of people from a certain community, I'll say. And a marriage will take place – and you'll see, oh, somebody got married on Facebook, and it'll just be a picture of the bride, and the husband won't be in the picture because of the fear of prosecution, and they won't ever post on Facebook who it is they're married to, and it's a shame that they feel they have to hide their families that way. To me, that's a crime. Not the hiding of it, but the fact that it has to be hid. Yeah. Well, I mean, what does that say to a child that grows up in that household? Why is my parents' love, why is my family a crime? It doesn't feel like a crime. I'm loved and cared for. Prosecute the crimes, not the families.
I have an amateur comment that might turn into a question.
Right.
It seems to me like the reason why monogamy is the norm in America is because it, at least up until recently, tended to be a better unit of production, because then you got all these males who were more willing to work much harder because that offspring was theirs, instead of all the offspring being for the elite. So we got a lot more work out of all of the males, because all of them got to partner and have children and therefore be invested. The machine got its teeth into them better. And I think that's one of the reasons why Americans feel so threatened about that, because they instinctually feel, oh, that's the motor of our country is monogamy. And then once you get just one male, you say, what do we do with all these unmarried males who don't feel as motivated? Mm-hmm. Is that actually supported by any of what you've read, or is that just me going off?
I think it's indirectly supported, because we were reading about the form of resource-based polygyny. And, I could see. I didn't read anything that directly attested to that fact, but that makes a lot of sense. Monogamy being the norm due to economic conditions. Because obviously, you do work harder when, you know, you got to feed the family, you know.
It's
very interesting. But then again, though, if you change the familial structure, you know, like this Oneida community, they all work together, you know, and raise the kids as one. So, yeah, it's a question. Now, here's a point, though, to build off of what you're saying. So it increases, you know, the economic output, which would result in the increase of the ability to tax.
Ooh, very good.
Right?
No wonder.
Which would greatly interest the government, right? So that makes sense, though. I think you're onto something there.
One more question. Mm-hmm. You've done an in-depth study on polygamy, and you mentioned that you don't believe in child rape, and most of us are really seriously against that, mm-hmm. and I agree with that myself. But have you really found a lot of polygamy-type activity here in the United States? That's, you got these underage marriages. Is this happening a lot, or you see hardly any or none? Or
it's definitely not the common practice. The issue with it is when it happens, it makes a good headline for a newspaper. You know what I mean? And so it's the cases of it are greatly exaggerated. When I first went to Colorado City, it was strictly out of curiosity. I had read, you know, all the early Mormon fundamentalist information. I knew what started the religion, and I knew, but I'd also read a lot of the current media. And so when I went there, I was expecting to see men walking down the road with, you know, trains of 14, 15-year-old brides, you know what I mean? And it just simply wasn't the case. Now, there are underage marriages which are illegal, and I don't want – this is a risky statement. But the few cases I have personally seen of it, just looking at it, you know what I mean, from an outside perspective – it would appear that those young women were sexually mature. They weren't little girls. In the few cases I've seen, that may sound really horrible for me to say to a lot of people, because the fact remains that they're not of age. But look at a different time. You know, many people here have Mormon ancestors, and even the ones that were monogamous, they were often getting married 16, 15 years of age. We view things a little differently now, according to our ages, and maybe we mature later. There's probably reasons for these laws, but I personally have not seen a lot of examples. I know they exist. I also know that when they happen, they're greatly highlighted, because it's an easy way to point fingers at a community you want to marginalize. Most polygamous families I know that I've become close to love the way they grew up.
All right. We've reached the 10 o'clock point. This has been fascinating. Thanks so much, everybody, for making an interesting conversation out of an interesting paper. And we will see you at the next session at 10:15.